You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We're listening to a telephone conversation recorded March 1st, 2010, by journalist Stephen Leahy, talking with world-famous climate scientist Stephen Schneider.
Now, one of the critiques a year ago of the IPCC was that it was too slow and becoming too complicated.
There's nothing you can do about that. It's a creation of 120 governments. They're not an NGO. They do not have a board to talk to. They have 120 governments. They cannot on their own just decide to go out there and answer criticism. So what ends up happening is you get comments of individual co-chairs and the general chair, and nobody speaks for the IPCC but the 100 governments who just, you know, had a meeting and said, let's get a review and that'll speak for us. I think that's great.
That'll take time, though.
Yeah, probably 6 months.
And
meanwhile, the liars and spin doctors will continue to frame IPCC as dishonorable, and as long as the fourth estate is not the fourth estate and keeps quoting it without quoting the batting average, then what they're really doing is the bidding of the liars and spin doctors by inadvertence, by lack of due diligence. That's why I wrote Science as a Contact Sport. I felt that the media is slipping out of its critical historic roles, my last chapter. And this has only made me even more worried than I was before.
Worried about the media.
Media's incapacity to be able to put context on claims and just reporting everybody as if they're all entitled to equal status at the bargaining table when they're not. How many times have I said in my 40-year career that science is not a democracy?
Yeah.
Science is evidence-based. Law is not a democracy. It's evidence-based. That if you're going to sit there and establish in the media the claims of everybody, and then say they were right, these were errors, without pointing out the batting average of the plays. And then tell me, as several journalists have, it's not our job to do batting average. Yes, it is.
I agree. It is. Should be.
Well, they don't think so. They said, if we catch a senator who's been, illegal, it doesn't matter how many good things they did. They've still been illegal, and we have to point it out. I never said they shouldn't point it out.
Yeah.
But this is not about illegality. This is about the relative competence of advice. The metaphor that I use is, if there's a cancer drug which works 90% of the time, are they only going to focus on the lawsuits for the 10% who died? And they're going to forget to say that there's no other treatment that does better than 50-50?
Yeah.
I mean, not to do that, in my opinion, is to shirk due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I believe the media, writ large, is doing, shirking due diligence.
Yeah.
Because the average member of the public will not look it up and is not competent to look it up. Because almost all the blogs are elliptical spin.
Well, that sort of raises the whole question of the role of the internet and blogging as a device.
Of the internet?
Yeah.
I teach a freshman seminar, freshman sophomore intro sem, called Environmental Literacy. It's an anti-propaganda course.
Hmm.
And what I try to teach my kids is how to learn to discern the quality of an argument.
Mm-hmm.
Watch out for the myth-busters and the truth-tellers and the ones with certain facts.
Yeah.
Listen to the apologists with, bell curves and ranges and ordering things into well-established competing explanations and speculative. They're almost always telling the truth. And the ones who know the answer and know who the villains are and all that, forget it. They're spinners. And once in a while, they're right. But most of the time, they're not. And that is something the public is exceedingly bad at.
Mm-hmm.
And the media used to do it for them because they had specialists who were gatekeepers of what information got released, and they put perspective on the relative credibility of arguments. Who's left doing that? Seth? Juliet sometimes? Haven't seen it out of Rosenthal.
Andy Refkin.
How many are left out there
is retired
in the environment world working for the mainstream? Who actually is smart enough to be able to smell the north end of a southbound horse.
Not many left in North America, anyways.
Not in North America.
Europe is doing still
there are okay. Some. Europe is better.
Yeah, except for the UK.
Australia is not very good.
No.
Almost all of them are in the ABC, in the print media, not many.
Yeah. Yeah, so what's the way forward there in terms of this?
I don't know. I write books on it. And nobody in the media You know, I haven't had one book review in the mainstream media.
Really?
The only one that came close was Sharon Begley in Newsweek, and it was her blog on the website. Huh. Never made Newsweek. Every other book I have done since Genesis Strategy in 1976 has been reviewed in all the major newspapers. I've been on national TV fighting and screaming, but nonetheless doing it. Not one national TV program. Well, not only one national radio program was Science Friday. Nobody's interested. And when the Super Freaks went on, I don't know where it was today, Good Morning America, something like that, the publicist at National Geographic, where I work, where my book is, that is, sent them an email and said, well, you just put on a reporter and a Chicago school economist completely misrepresenting climate science. Don't you have an obligation to put on somebody who is competent at it and also has a book? And they wrote back and they said, your client is just a scientist. Our guests are what our viewers want to watch. They are best-selling New York Times authors. He isn't.
Wow.
So it's a matter of whether you're a best-selling New York Times author, not whether you have credentials and whether you're right. That's the basis for determining who goes on Today or Good Morning America. That is such a deeply broken institution. I don't know why we have a First Amendment to protect a business in search of ratings. When are they going to do their job, as Walter Lippmann and, you know, as I said, and Ed Murrow taught them how 40 years ago? It's a pathetic state of an industry that's become an industry instead of a fourth estate.
Yeah, it's,
and it's dangerous to democracy, in my opinion. Please, media, I actually trust them. Get your old legs back.
I agree, it's a dangerous
situation. I trust them a lot more in the blogosphere, but they've abdicated because they're so frightened about going out of business with the wiki model that they're becoming one of them.
Yep. Let's jump back to the IPCC. The future AR5 is underway. Is it going to be any different in terms of scope or...
Oh, the scope's already been done.
Yeah, okay.
And it's on their website. It was a document approved at the Bali plenary by the 120 governments. And unless something happens because of all what's going on now, and the plenary, remember, the plenary is 120 governments, changes their mind, it's already scoped. All the scientists have already been nominated to national governments. They're all picking them. Nothing is going to change. It is possible leadership will change. It is possible procedures will change.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible the whole thing will change, but not likely. It's really not broken.
Analogies to the tobacco industry, this whole campaign.
Completely apt. There's a new book out on it, too. Talk to Her, from Naomi Oreskes.
Oh, yes. I do know Naomi.
UCSD. It's coming out soon.
Okay, I think...
I'm supposed to write them a jacket comment. I don't even have time to read it. I just had dinner with her when I was down at AAAS. She basically shows that some of the same architects of climate disinformation were, in fact, including Fred Singer and Fred Seitz, were in the tobacco disinformation movement earlier. Same people, same tactics, tried and true. And here's our fourth estate falling for it again.
Yeah, that's the very, very disquieting part.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about that extensively in my book.
Yeah.
The one that's never been reviewed by mainstream media. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing, actually.
It's seven or eight books reviewed all over the place. I haven't seen one review in a newspaper.
And it's topical, on top of that.
Right. And it's about the process, including them. I don't think they want to quote the fact that I think that they're a deeply broken institution that has to find its roots. I don't think they want to hear that.
Yeah, well, if that's the case, then it's sad.
Well, that's, I say that.
Yeah.
But the trouble is, I only trust them to do it. I do not trust the blogsters.
No, I agree.
Because blogsters are, by and large, elliptical. And they're only read by their own people. They're not read by the others.
Yeah, that's...
It has to find its roots.
Yep.
Again, we need them. My criticisms are not out of anger. They're out of love.
Mm-hmm.
We need them.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, I'm pretty damn angry that they put money ahead of truth. But of course, that's not the reporters. That's their management. But I don't see them organizing unions to fight their management.
No.
I don't mean unions for salary. I mean unions for truth.
This is, and just to jump back to climate for a minute, this is obviously going to have an impact on whether or not there's any kind of international treaty on climate.
Or national.
or national.
Without a U.S. agreement, there's not going to be much international. Why do you think these guys and the forces of darkness are trying to do this? Mm-hmm. Because if they can keep the U.S. from doing anything by lying, cheating, spin-doctoring, and not being assaulted in the media, then that's going to poison the waters in the international group when the largest accumulator emitter, the United States, is not doing its own due diligence.
Yeah, pretty simple game in a way. Just make sure one of them, the U.S. doesn't...
This is all about market share and timing. These guys know they've lost the war. We're right, scientifically. They're wrong. That's demonstrated, in my opinion, beyond a reasonable doubt. So all they have to do is character assassination, innuendo, catch some errors, reframe the debate in a false frame, count on the media to cover it, throw everybody into confusion, delay 2 years, and maybe get back one House of Congress and then completely kill America's action for the foreseeable future. That's their strategy, and you know what? It's got at least a 50% chance it's going to work. Again, they did it in 92, and they're doing it again. It's all in science of contact sport, except not the recent incarnation. This is so much worse than I said in my book. It's all the same elements, but it's even worse because it's hard for us to get a hearing out there. The media is so locked into false balance.
Well, I thought we were over the false balance thing a year ago.
Well, have you seen a media story yet? Seth Bornstein.
Yeah.
He did say that the actual errors are really pretty small out of the batting average. But he didn't. That was not in his lead. That was two-thirds of the way down in the article. And that could very well have been done by his editors.
Yeah.
Not Seth.
Yeah.
That's the one mainstream story I saw. And the New York Times and Washington Post wrote editorials where they said the errors were trivial. 12 weeks too late. Finally.
Finally, yeah.
12 weeks. Let's face it, this is a great man-bites-dog story. Temple of high science caught in error.
Mm-hmm.
That is a good story. I'm not against them covering it. But you've got to put in the same story the batting average. And the batting average of every other way to know. What's Inhofe's batting average? Zero.
Zero.
Yeah, he strikes out and gets in the Hall of Fame.
Well, partially what we're losing is this idea of objective truth. Everything's become opinion now.
There's no such thing in science. What I keep saying in all my talks is, can we please get rid of this stupid, meaningless phrase, exact science? There's no such thing.
Yeah.
We approximate truth. And when we have so many experiments that it's not worth checking anymore, like gravity or the greenhouse effect, we declare it well-established and move on to competing explanations and speculative components because it's foolish to sit and continuously reinvestigate what we know. And they then claim, oh, but they've reinvestigated and found it flawed. Almost all their arguments are deeply flawed, demonstrably flawed, shown to be flawed, and all they do is keep repeating them. And then they get the ditto heads, you know, and the Tea Partiers to repeat them and then send ugly four-letter word-laced death threatish emails to us for intimidation, feeling that they're doing their patriotic duty by doing this. I have hundreds.
I would think you do now, and I know mine has increased as well. And you're a much higher profile.
You know, you worry because these are the gun toters, whether one of them is like that lunatic who flew into the building. I mean, you got to worry about those guys.
Yeah.
We are vulnerable to that.
Well, let's hope it doesn't come to pass, that's for sure.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, they shoot abortion doctors. I mean, when you're deranged and ideological in a gun-toting country, that's not a great thing. Fortunately, the probability for any one individual will be dramatically low, probably lower than you're getting in a car crash. So I'm not going to sit there and let it affect me. But, you know, it's going to happen.
Who wants to be in
the... A lunatic is not promoted to tenure and comes in and shoots your colleagues?
True.
The postal worker syndrome?
And that says, why would you want to be a scientist on the IPCC now?
Well, don't think that we haven't been getting young people asking, should I really risk this? I've got to go because I have somebody coming. Anything else we need to talk about?
No, I think that's it. It's good to chat again. And
go out and fight. We need everything we can get.
I guess I got to be busy again. Yeah, okay.
Yep, go for it.
All right, you too.
Take care.
All right, bye.
Thanks. Bye.
That was Stephen H. Schneider talking with Stephen Leahy. Find links to Schneider's webpage in my Radio EcoShock blog dated March 11th. And you'll find links to Stephen Leahy's IPS article titled Violent Backlash Against Climate Scientists, as published in the Tierra America Network, hundreds of papers on March 8th. Canadian climate scientist and IPCC contributor Dr. Andrew Weaver told Leahy, "We're in a bizarre time, powered by greed and fear. The general public is more confused than ever. And good scientists are saying to themselves, why would I want to participate in the IPCC? The newspaper world, my friends, is falling into bankruptcy due to debt-laden mergers and acquisitions, competitions from free information on the internet, and a general move from print to audio and video. Hordes of good reporters have lost their jobs, and would you believe it, newspapers tend to let environment reporters go first. What a surprise. Are they protecting their big business advertisers? No, no, of course not. It's just coincidence. You can help. Stephen Leahy may be the new model, a journalist who works directly for his or her readers. Stephen is off on a whirlwind tour of three continents, covering conferences ranging from forestry to the sickening oceans. He's your reporter, but Stephen needs your help to keep going. Please visit his webpage at stephenleahy.net, where you can adopt an environmental journalist with a small donation by PayPal. Steve has two kids to feed, and we need to keep him going. Stephen has a PH in it, and Leahy is spelled Leahy.net. Do it. I've been reading about harassment and death threats to climate scientists most recently in that five excellent part series by Clive Hamilton. The most recent installment, published in Scientific American, has the subject head, "Researchers must purge email boxes daily of threatening correspondence, simply part of the job of being a climate scientist," end quote. This is the last gasp of the fossil fuel age. The men who make billions every quarter, they can keep this thing going the longer they can stall. They're buying whoever they can in the media, the blogosphere, and the houses of government. And this is all tied into a long-standing conspiracy that goes deeper than mere money. It finds a home in libertarians and ideologues who fear big government or they hate it. A recent report by the Southern Poverty Law Center says disgruntled Americans are being whipped up by well-known media figures like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh. Somehow, in muddled minds, the science of climate change has been deftly attached to 9/11, unemployment, and the new extreme patriot groups. The report is called Rage on the Right. The militias, the gun nuts, and the haters are back. They fly planes into the IRS or attack the Pentagon single-handed. Both Leahy and Schneider worry it's just a matter of time before a climate scientist is shot as well. I hope they are so wrong. But just imagine the coming madness of crowds after a series of strange climatic events, after a heat wave kills thousands, after a megastorm wipes out another city, after the crops fail again. Our picture of society may fall off the wall as anger takes over. We'll now go to the real conspiracy, three scientists who frightened the world, who morphed from cold warriors into anti-environmentalism, the founders of the current climate denialism, the institute they founded named after World War II warrior General George C. Marshall, took tobacco money and then oil money to stop government action, to endanger millions of lives and future generations. We'll get the story from the author of a new book, Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscure the Truth About Climate Change. Naomi Oreskes is a professor of history and science studies at the University of California, San Diego. She spoke at the University of Rhode Island on March 2, 2010. You're going to hear a fairly long clip from that speech. Find the whole thing on the Climate 2010 page of our website, ecoshock.org. This is Naomi Oreskes.
In the book, we track the story of a small handful of Cold War physicists, a relatively small number of people who had a big impact because they were powerful and influential, and because they, through their Cold War work, you know, were known by admirals and generals and senators and governors, and even were invited to the White House to brief presidents because they were very influential and important people. But instead of promoting the results of their own scientific colleagues' work, instead they promoted the idea of doubt, of the exploitation of scientific uncertainty to avoid regulatory action on a set of issues, as I've said, ranging from tobacco control to global warming. So there are three principal players in the story and one think tank. The three principal players are these men shown here. On the left, Robert Jastrow, an astrophysicist who was the head of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies. So you see, these were all extremely prominent people, and that's part of the story. If they hadn't been prominent, I don't believe they would have had credibility with the mass media. They wouldn't have had access to the corridors of power, but they did. In the middle, Frederick Seitz, the former president of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, president of the Rockefeller University, and also a consultant to the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. And on the right, this man, known to quite a few people in this audience, William Nirenberg, a nuclear physicist and the longtime director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Well, you never liked those guys anyway, right? And the think tank is the think tank that these three men founded in 1984, the George C. Marshall Institute. They founded the Marshall Institute originally to defend Ronald Reagan's strategic defense initiative against the scientist boycott of it. Some of you will remember that in the early 1980s, when Ronald Reagan first proposed the idea of strategic defense or Star Wars, there was a massive reaction against it by physicists and engineers who thought that it would be politically destabilizing and was generally a bad idea. Jastrow, Nirenberg, and Seitz were part of a small minority of physicists who supported SDI and wanted to create a mechanism to counterbalance the publicity that mainstream physicists were getting in the mass media. And so they created the Marshall Institute in order to get their views heard and by demanding equal time from the media. So when the media quoted Carl Sagan and Hans Bethe and many other physicists saying SDI is a bad idea, it will be destabilizing, it could provoke the very first strike that it's supposedly intended to prevent, these men would call up newspapers and say, well, excuse us, but we want equal time for our views. And they got it. So from 1984 to 1989, for about 5 years, they spent most of their time, and Nirenberg and Seitz were retired. Jastrow was retired at this point, too. They were all retired from the jobs they had had for most of their careers, and they dedicated themselves to defending SDI. And they did this, and this is one of the this story is filled with paradoxes and ironies. Later, they would accuse environmentalists of being alarmists, but they themselves defended SDI by promoting an extremely alarming view of Soviet strength, a view that was later shown to be quite incorrect, and a very alarming view of American weakness. So just to give you one example of the kind of alarmism that they promoted, in 1987, Robert Jastrow published this article in the National Review under the title, America Has 5 Years Left. I mean, as alarmist as Al Gore or Jim Hansen have ever been, I don't think they ever said we only have 5 years left to deal with global warming. But in this article, he insisted that the Soviet was about to overtake us in military strength, and that unless we improved our military capacity immediately, within 5 years, the Soviet Union would overtake us, dominate Europe, dictate terms in the Middle East, and essentially take over the world. Well, that didn't turn out to be true. At the time, Fred Seitz was working as a consultant to the R.J. Reynolds Corporation. And as many of you know, and has been written about in several books, including a wonderful book by Alan Brandt, professor at Harvard, called The Cigarette Century, the principal strategy that the tobacco industry used to defend tobacco against the mounting scientific and medical evidence of its harms was what we refer to in our book as doubt mongering. That is to say, to insist over and over and over again that the science was unsettled, that we didn't really know, that there were very substantial scientific uncertainties, and that therefore it was premature for the government to act to control tobacco. We just didn't know, was their mantra. So in 1989, these two strands, the Cold War defense of SDI and Seitz's work with the tobacco industry, merged. Now, 1989 is not a coincidental year because, as some of you will remember, it's also the year that the Cold War ended. Soviet Union fell apart, and shortly after, the Berlin Wall fell. So you might have thought that Jastrow and Seitz and Nirenberg, whose whole reason, the raison d'etre for the Marshall Institute, the whole reason they had come together to create this institute was to defend the United States against the Soviet threat, well, suddenly there was no Soviet threat. And these men were all, by this point, in their late 70s or even early 80s. They'd had very successful scientific careers. So you might have thought that they might have said, great, we won the Cold War. Life is good. Let's retire and play golf. It's not what they did. Instead, they found a new enemy. And that new enemy was what they called environmental extremism, what they considered to be the exaggeration of environmental threats and the insistence that government regulation was needed to control these threats. So basically, they began to take on a set of environmental issues, starting with acid rain, then the ozone hole. They became engaged in a big argument in the mid-90s about secondhand smoke, and finally global warming. And then later, they actually returned to an old argument about DDT. So these are, in the book, we have a chapter on each of these debates. In every single case, these men denied the severity of the problem And in every single case, they insisted that the science was too uncertain to justify government intervention in the marketplace. And I think this is really important because I think it begins to show an important pattern. It could be that the science of the ozone hole was uncertain. That might have been the case. It could have been true. I'm not saying it was, but it could, in theory, have been true. But acid rain and ozone and tobacco and global warming, it was always the same argument. No matter what the science was, no matter who the scientists were, no matter what agency was funding it, these men always attacked it as insufficient. They always used the tobacco strategy. And they always said that it would be wrong for the government to interfere in the marketplace to control the threat. So as I said, this was the strategy developed by the marketplace, developed by the tobacco industry. And in fact, there's a very infamous memo that has been cited now in a number of books that goes like this. Doubt is our product, since it is the best means of competing with the, quote, body of fact that exists in the minds of the general public. So this was written by a tobacco industry executive in 1969, and this was the strategy that was then applied to all these other campaigns. So this is why we call it doubt mongering. We call the book Merchants of Doubt, because it was all about using this play from the tobacco playbook to use doubt to make people feel that it would be too soon to act on a problem. But none of that would have been credible. I mean, most of us are smart enough to realize the tobacco industry executives have a vested interest, right? So the tobacco industry understood that for these claims to be credible, they had to be supplied by scientists. And so the tobacco industry, going back to the 1950s, hired scientists to do this work. And Frederick Seitz was one of their important people who did this. And he brought that strategy then into these other debates. Obviously, for the details, you can read the book. But I want to just spend a few minutes now talking about why we fell for it. Why has this strategy been so effective again and again and again over the course of the 50 years? The tobacco industry began doing this in 1954. That's before I was born and before any of you guys were born, right? It's a long time ago. This has been going on for half a century. So why did we fall for it, and why do we keep falling for it? But we also fell for it, we argue, because we have a wrong view of science. Because we've been taught a wrong view of science in school and in our textbook. And that wrong view is that we think that science provides proof. We expect science to provide proof. And therefore, when someone raises doubts, when someone says, oh, but there's this little thing over here that isn't resolved, or there's this question here that people are still uncertain about, or a scientist says, well, it's complicated, right? Then we think that there's something wrong with the science. But what we want to argue is that there's nothing wrong with the science. And in fact, it's what's right with the science, that science, the normal process of doing scientific research, involves engaging with doubt, engaging with uncertainty, but working through it.
So there is the real conspiracy. Not by climate scientists to take over the world, but by industry hacks and Cold Warrior ideologues to keep us upset and stupid while the world burns. Beware the doubters and deniers. But that was history. Now in 2010, the anti-science belief system, sprouted by three American scientists, has grown into a cult, for now, and threatens to become a popular movement. Nature and physics don't care what you believe. What is coming will come. I'm Alex Smith. Write me anytime, radio@ecoshock.org.
Player 25, 25.